This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
At times I just don't know how you could be anything but beautiful.
Over the course of a career that has lasted more than 50 years, Canadian singer-songwriter Gordon Lightfoot has achieved global stardom and exceptional influence. Bob Dylan's a fan. About Lightfoot's songs, Dylan said, "I can't think of any I don't like." These songs, which include Beautiful, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, If You Could Read My Mind, and many others, have been treasured by generations of popular musicians and listeners around the world. Many people know about the folk music revival that brought Bob Dylan to New York in the early 1960s. But north of the border, there was an equivalent explosion of talent at that time. And Lightfoot, who got his start singing in boys' choirs, found himself heading to Canada's cultural capital to try his luck.
Well, I was down in Toronto here looking for work, and I got a job as a choral performer in a television series that was on every week. And at the same time, I branched out and began working in the folk oriented places, because the folk revival had occurred around about 1960, and I would have been maybe 20 years old thereabouts, 21, and so I'd be working on the TV show in the daytime and going out and working at the coffee houses at night.
No, you had a period where you wrote jingles for commercials, correct?
I tried
to make a living.
They locked me in a room one time, a manager in a place on Madison Avenue, and just left me there all afternoon.
How'd that go?
Well, I wrote the commercial, but they just they didn't like it.
They didn't like it. They didn't play your version of the commercial. But you weren't in New York for a long time, correct?
Well, I would go back and forth to New York all the time
because
my management company was in New York. I was one of the fortunate ones who was able to acquire a management situation south of the border, so to speak, mm-hmm. down in the States, and that was in New York. And it was a great manager. He recognized my songwriting ability immediately, and I got a couple of tunes recorded by Peter, Paul, and Mary, and one of them went up to number 5 on the Billboard chart for Loving Me.
Wow.
That's what you get for loving me. That's what you get for loving me. Everything you had is gone, as you can see. That's what you get for loving me.
And so I was introduced to the industry in the States really as a songwriter before they even knew that I sang. You know, it sort of happened on its own.
Do you think you would have been happy to just stay in that place and just produce records and write music, and was performing the goal all along? Were you itching to do that?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to. Even as a child, I didn't mind singing in my grandmother's house on the Sunday get-togethers, they would single me out and I would solo. I enjoyed the feel of the communication that I could feel it then. And that's what I feel now. I feel a communication when I have a wonderful band and we have a great repertoire and we just lay the stuff right out there for them.
Just pure joy.
Yeah,
fun.
I enjoy doing that.
Yeah, but when you were
particularly if it pays the bills,
well, that's a desirable silver lining there.
Yeah,
benefit. Yeah, all that hard work. Well, but when you were writing, when did you turn that corner and singing takes over?
You know, I was doing like small time stuff, and all of a sudden I was asked to come to New York and open for a Paul Butterfield concert.
Mm-hmm.
1966, thereabouts, mm-hmm. I suppose. 67.
Were you on the radio then recording?
No, we didn't actually get on the radio until about 1971.
And what was the first song that, I have a list here, but what was the first, If You Could Read My Mind?
If You Could Read My Mind.
You know
changed is me. And I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost you can't see.
The record was out. It was my first album on Warner Brothers. And it was out for 8 months, and there was no single. And all of a sudden, one of the promotion guys said to his girlfriend, "Will you listen to this and come back and give me an opinion on it?" And Monday morning, his girlfriend, she likes if he could read my mind.
Where the heartaches come, the hero would be me. Heroes often fail, and you won't read that book again because the ending just too hard to.
If You Could Read My Mind hits the charts, so to speak, and becomes a big hit for you, what changes for you? Like, did you have to sit there and say, people are telling you to do things differently and now you're going to be a success and they want you to...
We get so busy, we got to hire an aircraft.
Literally.
That's what happened. Literally. We had to hire an aircraft.
Everyone wants to book you, they want you to play.
Same place, two different places in one day. So...
When you reach that point and that turning point, is the next imperative? You got to start coming up with more songs and writing more songs.
Oh, yeah.
They want you to record.
Yeah, we made three more albums and nothing happened. But I kept doing one a year and something had to give eventually. And then one summer I wrote that song Sundown and I knew that it was going to happen. That it was the right thing, and it did. We went up to number one. That was our second one. Then it was almost two albums later that we had the record of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and that happened all by itself too. That became a responsibility.
Right.
It did a very large responsibility.
The song became a responsibility.
Yeah, the record of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
But tell me in your own words. Many people go on about that, about the tragedy and the history, and it's a very, important song to people. In Canadian history, people talk about it very reverentially. Why was it important to you?
Because it was only one verse contained any conjecture of any kind, and the rest of it was taken directly from newspaper articles and the aftermath, which only lasted for about 3 days. If I had not wrote that song, everybody would have forgotten about it a week after it happened. I said people are all around the Great Lakes area are going to wonder if the song is appropriate, and some did wonder about it,
mm-hmm.
whether it was appropriate for me to have written a song of that kind. But I had gone pretty much with the newspaper articles that I scraped up. We had no CPs in those days, and you went to the publisher and got the back copies of the newspapers,
mm-hmm.
and. So it's accurate. It's accurate in the way the story unfolds. I remember the night I wrote it, I was working in a deserted house, and there was a heck of a windstorm going on right in Toronto that night. And I remember myself wondering, gee, I wonder what it's like up on the Great Lakes right now, because I sailed up there myself. I had two different sailboats up there. And wondered always, I wonder what the Great Lakes are like tonight, because you're always hearing about things happening up in the Great Lakes. And at 11 o'clock in the evening, there was a report of a ship sinking 3 hours earlier in Lake Superior. And they were out looking for the people. And they never found any of them. And 29 people gone. And I had a melody and I had some chords. That I was knocking around in this deserted house with the wind howling outside my... Really, it was kind of a classic setting to write a song like that. So I began writing the song and finished writing it like 2 or 3 weeks later. We were right in the middle of a series of recording sessions at the time, so we put it in. And it didn't work the first day. We put it in the second day, and... did you ever hear Stompin' Tom Connors?
No.
Oh,
I will now. I'm going to run out and get all of Stompin' Tom Connors.
He was one of our very famous Canadian folk artists. Stompin' Tom Connors poked his head and said, "That sounds like a hit." He just heard the the melody going, like he hadn't heard the lyrics or anything. So the appeal of the song is definitely in the melody and the chord changes. And then the story of the actual event itself, I got as accurately as I could by pursuing old news articles.
The wind and the wires made a tattletale sound, and the wave broke over the railing. And every man knew, as the captain did too, 'twas the Witch of November come stealing. The dawn came late and the breakfast had to wait, when the gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain in the face of a hurricane west wind.
What was recording and performing music like back then? Did it seem simpler to you? What was it like for you to be you and do what you do in the early days as compared to later on and to now, for that matter?
The first time I started doing it, I felt not confident in what I was doing, what I was hearing. I didn't like what I was hearing.
Of your own stuff?
Yeah, I didn't like the sound of my voice bothered me. And you know, I started working on that stuff, and I've been working on it ever since, on my vocal, and I've worked on my intonation on my instruments.
Someone told me that when you land, because you perform in so many different areas, you really dwell on tuning your instruments a lot, correct?
Yeah, sometimes I chase it around too, but I've learned through the years that there is a method that can get me into Scarborough Fair country, you know, like the sound that Simon and Garfunkel used to get on their acoustic orchestral arrangements that they put together,
right,
for their songs,
right.
and it actually only came real for me maybe 6 or 7 years ago, after I was recovering from a mini stroke that I had, and I had to practice a lot more all of a sudden.
Right.
So it really got me zeroing in on it, and it all comes down to the fifths and the octaves, and I'll just leave it at that.
I'm just a handmaiden here. For all you guitar people out there, that's Gordon Lightfoot's gift to you and his present to you. It's the fifths and the octaves, and I don't have one damn idea what he's...
The fifths and the octaves.
The fifths and the octaves. I don't know what the hell he's talking about, but there it is. There's his message to you today.
Yeah, open.
McCartney told me when I spoke to him once, Paul told me that he said in the beginning they would go into a recording studio, the Beatles. And he said, you know, it was really, these weren't his words, but the message was kind of like, time is money. He said, these guys were like, you know, we want two songs in the morning, and then you go have a lunch break, and you go down to the pub, and you have a cigarette, and you have a fish and chips, or whatever, you come back, they want two songs in the afternoon. They really moved along at a clip when they were doing the first albums Parlophone or whoever it was, or EMI.
Yeah.
And then when they became, you know, the success they obviously became, then they would take a year. You know, all musicians are the same. Then they would take a year to do their next album. You know, they would do Sgt. Pepper's or whatever and really, really luxuriate. They gave them more time because it was worth that investment for them. Was the same true with you? Do you find that the more successful you became, the more time you wanted to make music?
Perhaps later on, but I pretty much stuck to the schedule as much as I could. We made like 8 or 9 albums in 10 years there, so.
You didn't feel rushed by them?
No, we were getting more time.
Right.
But I was also improving because what I didn't like hearing, I was changing all the time.
Right.
And I was always on an improvement venture. Like a guy building himself up and for to play on an important sports team, you know.
Right.
They got it. It's just not just the game, it's the preparation. Say you haven't played for a month, and all of a sudden you got to get back up on stage, you should be able to crank it out just like it was just you did a show last night.
Right. But you liked rehearsing.
Yeah, well,
you believed in rehearsing.
Yeah, or you're learning new material, or you're going back into the old catalog, which we do because I have a rotational situation going on. My biggest problem my whole life has been too many tunes, too many women.
For my listeners right now, Gordon Lightfoot is turning sheepishly toward his wife with a sheepish grin on his face, and she just patted his shoulder to say, "It's okay, Gordon."
Well, I can't step on your toes, you know.
Yeah, you can't do that. But I remember reading, I remember listening to an article that the Rolling Stones did years ago, and I was taken by how, you know, in terms of musicianship, Jagger and Keith Richard were very, very married to rehearsal. And for you to say that, that has great meaning to me. For you, someone who's as great an artist as you are, the preparation beforehand. So that when the audience is there, boom, you strum that guitar and you're ready. You're ready.
Yeah, and we have the orchestra itself. I have four really talented guys
and very loyal people. I read about that. Your band is very loyal to you.
Well, I mean, there's no reason why they should not be. We're all on the same path. I mean, we just want to do a great job, and you got to make a science out of it. I don't know. My guys are all professionals. I mean, they're
serious musicians.
Yeah, and they do other things. I just got to let them know what's coming up, you know.
What were you listening to back then in the 60s when you were coming up? Who did you listen to?
Well, I was listening to country music, you know, Hank Snow, and then in folk it was Pete Seeger, and it was Bob Gibson, and it was Bob Dylan, and Simon and Garfunkel, and, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Ian and Sylvia. They were a duet, and it was a beautiful act that they had. So
eventually you met these people.
Well, I met
but you became one of them.
My management company, because they were the first ever to do any of my songs. It was Ian and Sylvia.
Right. Which one?
For Loving Me and Early Morning Rain. I found an opening with the folk revival, you know, so I was lucky to be a part of that, to ride that one through and survive. Mm-hmm. There's nothing much out there these days. You know, they're busking. We've got a whole bunch of people here in Toronto who are hovering around all the time, the folk-oriented artists that, who are songwriters and, you know, trying to get somewhere. And some of them are succeeding and some are not. I get to hear a lot of the stuff because it comes across my desk and I get to hear it. And you wish, you know, that something grand could happen for these people, but you don't know what to do. All you can do is respond.
Right. Encourage.
Yeah.
Where do you think people learn to hone their craft as a musician? In clubs and performing live?
Well, I was working in bars, too, you know, like bars and lounges, as well as the coffee houses. And so I had the kind of a repertoire that was acceptable to play in bars. So I got a following in a couple of these bars. Mm-hmm. Then I sort of moved uptown into the village area, you know, Yorkville, which was just coming into bloom here, mm-hmm. in town, and get into places like the Purple Onion and then the Riverboat, which was really the plum of the whole lot was the Riverboat because... Bernie Feeder brought every person into that place you could possibly imagine, played there, right from James Taylor to Joni Mitchell to Neil Young, right on down the line.
Is he a friend of yours? Or
yes, he is.
Yeah. Your songs and your singing of your songs, your performing of your songs is so vulnerable and so emotional. What was the most difficult song for you to write or among the most difficult songs for you to write?
I tell you that a lot of the times you don't know you're doing it. You're drawing the material from your subconscious. You don't actually know what you're doing. You're drawing it from somewhere, and then later down the line, 3 or 4 weeks later, you can assign it back to the actual event that brought it on. I mean that's. Like if you could read my mind is about actually the crumbling of a relationship.
Was that painful for you to write?
No, because I didn't know what I was doing when I wrote it.
You're telling me that all these beautiful folk songs that people weep when they listen to, you're just like tossing it off like, I don't really know what this is. Let's take a song, for example. Let me pick one song. Now, one of my favorite songs of yours, I mean, a song that just kills me, is Beautiful. Describe to me recording the song Beautiful. I mean, do you go out with your friends and you get shit-faced drunk and you come in with a hangover and just lay this thing down and you play poker all night? Or do you enter a state?
First, I get a chord progression. Then I get a melody.
It's fifths and octaves, people. It's fifths and octaves.
Then I get the lyric. You got the melody, you got the chords, but you don't know. So you draw, you find an idea that fits the melody.
That's Gordon Lightfoot, the songwriter. Gordon Lightfoot, the singer, the performer. Do you enter a state? Do you take yourself to a place when you perform your recorded music, or you don't?
Well, I can use my imagination.
Right.
I actually saw it as a sincere love tune to a guy for his wife or his girlfriend. It reminds me when I learned how to sing with emotion when I was about 12, when I was handling material from Handel's Messiah.
It overtook you.
The voice of him who cries in the wilderness and all that sort of thing. And I learned what emotion meant when I sang Handel's Messiah at age 12. I sang in competition. So I could apply, it was easier for me to apply to sum it up, that emotional something or whatever it is when it came time to put that song down. But I didn't have it to the point at the beginning that I wanted to have it, and that's why I've been working on it all my life, is getting, controlling that emotional approach to it, making it work for me. You don't want to overdo it. You know, you don't
right.
want to get
and you don't.
Sappy. You don't
well,
want
but
to get
saying, that's what's beautiful about your music, yeah. is you go right up to a point. But you don't do a lot of hand-holding. You let the audience do the crying for you. You know what I mean?
We balance it off with a lot of toe-tappers. We got lots of toe-tappers.
Yeah, that's true. For a prime example of the delivery Gordon Lightfoot does so well, you don't have to look beyond this song, Sundown.
I can see her lying back in her satin dress.
Coming up, Lightfoot talks about some of his musical inspirations and explains why he and Bob Dylan didn't get along right away. Explore the Here's the Thing archives. I talk with a very different kind of songwriter, Tom York, from the British rock band Radiohead. He tells me how his producer gave him the confidence to explore wild new electronic sounds.
I mean, I was like a kid being given a hammer. I was just hammering away on stuff. I didn't really know what I was doing. But he was kind of fascinated by that, you know, and he'd come and literally tidy up the mess I'd done on the computer.
Right. Take a listen at heresthething.org.
I'm telling you that you're beautiful.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Gordon Lightfoot has straddled the worlds of pop and folk music for decades, but his confessional songwriting appealed to country music performers like Johnny Cash, Hank Williams Jr., and Glen Campbell as well. They all covered his songs, and there's good reason. That's what Lightfoot was listening to when he started thinking about what kind of musician he wanted to be.
It was probably a country music. I made the crossover into adult contemporary music, you know, fairly soon. And there was a lot of good writing going on in the folk revival, too, and I was influenced by that.
So you didn't come into the music business and say, I want to be Sinatra, I want to be Elvis, I want to be Dylan.
Well, I think
you wanted to find your own voice.
Yeah, I didn't. I certainly did not take lightly the fact that I was really influenced by Bob Dylan. Because of the not only the quality of the work, but the output that they achieved.
He was prolific.
Yeah, that was the amazing part about it. And it said, well, if it can be that easy for him, it must surely be easier for me. I mean, if he can do this much work, surely I can do this much work. Mm-hmm. While appreciating the music that he was producing at the time.
When did you first meet him?
1965.
Mm-hmm. What was that like for you?
In Woodstock. Well, it was an interesting time. We actually didn't get along when we first met. he criticized my rules at playing Manhattan on his pool table in Woodstock, and I got a little sarcastic about it, he was very sarcastic. Mm-hmm. And I started seeing this coming on to me, and I left. I left their house.
Wow.
And went back down the hill to Albert's house. Albert Grossman. Oh. He was the manager. Right. I had become part of that stable.
That family, that stable, yeah.
So needless to say, since I knew him for so many years after that, because we're all working out of the same place, I became the sort of party central for them when they came to Toronto,
right,
which was often, and with the band and everybody, and we had a great time. And it was good to have known Bob.
Is it safe to say, because I've read this in different articles and so forth when I was reading up about you, that when you say you got together and had a good time, was there a period of your life where you had too much of a good time?
Well, I mean, there was lots of drinking went on. Yeah, there was a little bit of everything went
sure.
on. It just depended upon how severely you were affected by it and what kind of a constitution that you possessed.
Right.
I did. I drank heavily right up until 1982, and then all of a sudden I stopped. And
why?
I stopped for 23 years.
Why?
Because it was going to ruin my career. And I was making irrational decisions. And one night I tried to climb from one balcony to the next in an apartment building on the 10th floor.
Yeah, I get it. Sure,
and
sure,
there was
sure.
a party going on.
You wanted to go from one party?
Yeah.
I love that. What was a better party in that other wing over there?
No,
I tried to climb.
It was all the same. There was two
balconies. I want to meet those folks.
There was room for me to jump from the one balcony to the next.
Did you make it?
Yes. I've said it. I was here talking to you.
Well, you might have fallen and broken your leg or something. Who knows?
I was on the 10th floor. I wouldn't be here.
You wouldn't be here.
Things like that, you know.
But now
other things that I did, there were bad judgments, you know, with people, and I felt that I was offending people sometimes. And I did. So the last thing I wanted to do was offend anyone, you know. And that's what I felt when I wrote to Fitzgerald. I said, I hope I'm not going to offend any of the relatives of these men. You know,
was it ever communicated to you that you had? Did anybody suggest that?
No. It never was.
They appreciated what you did.
It's been honored. We just went to the 40th anniversary ourselves just this last November.
Where was it held?
In Lake Superior, up in 15 miles, 30 miles northwest of Sault Ste. Marie at Whitefish Point.
Wow. You have had some very impactful health issues. You had a stroke, and then you had Bell's palsy, and you couldn't have... What's it like to lose feeling in your fingers, and you're a guitar player?
Well, ask me what it was like when I had the aortal aneurysm.
Okay. What was it like when you had the aortal aneurysm?
Well, it put me out of business for 2 years.
Did it really?
Yeah, it put me out of business for 2 years.
What year was that?
2002.
What were the symptoms of that?
You pass out and you don't wake up.
Oh, I mean, literally the aneurysm burst.
For 6 weeks, yeah.
What were you feeling in the weeks prior?
I would have bouts of stomach ache, and I'd have to lay out on my belly on the bed.
Right.
For a while. Yeah, then it would subside, and that went on over a period of several years. And it started about 10 years before the actual event occurred. So there is a warning. There are warning signals. It's a pain. You get a pretty bad stomach ache. And
you had Bell's palsy as well?
Yeah, that was years ago. That was 1960s.
You were young.
Yeah.
72, I think?
Thereabouts, yeah. I had to stop performing for 3 months, and then I got enough of a stopped puffing enough that I was able to go back to work again.
Really?
So I just bowled her through, so to speak.
And then you had a stroke.
And it gradually came back. That was a mini stroke that affected my right hand, which was very disturbing. That was in 2006. That was when I really started practicing, and that's when I really learned how to really get my instruments in tune at the same time. So I derived a benefit from that.
Mm-hmm. How do American radio interview hosts differ from Canadian radio interview hosts?
No difference that I can see.
No difference to you. Thank you.
People,
that's very kind of you.
Folks are folks. I south of the border.
Always appreciate a kind word.
We're all cousins. We're all cousins here in North America. If that's the way.
You're not political now.
That's probably why I never moved down there. I follow. I'm a political fan. I'm a fan. Of watching the political process.
You're an observer. Well, you had the situation with the song in Detroit, Black Day in July.
Yeah.
From the Detroit riots.
That's right.
And you wrote a song about that, and it caused you a little bit of a grief.
And the record company released a single.
Did you feel that was something that you resented? Or, like, how did you feel when you got pulled into that?
Well, I kind of shouldn't have done that. It was almost like the wreck. Well, it was... Well, I should have. I was working in the city a lot in the
Detroit
radio circuit there. There was something about it I kept saying, maybe I shouldn't have written a song like this, you know. It was written as a folk song for an album.
Right.
The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald was written as a folk song for an album. And
so political purpose is assigned by other people. You didn't have a political purpose when you wrote the song.
No.
Right. Interesting.
Just a story.
Right.
Black Day in July and the soul of Motor City is bared across the land. As the book of law and order is taken in the hands of the sons of the fathers who were carried to this land. Black Day in July. Black Day in July.
And when the record company took the song off the air, so it didn't piss you off, the record companies never pissed you off?
No.
Never?
No, they were
when they
were
told
great.
You what songs to put on the album, what songs not to put on the album, it never bothered you?
Well, we always worked that out together.
You did?
Yeah.
Interesting.
With exceptions. This was very early in the career, too, before I had the level of authority that I needed to establish. I was in-house produced, and I used to be able to discuss things with them there. And very fortunately to be able to do that.
What song that when you sing it, you could sit there and go, man, I really, really nailed that. That's a good song.
Oh,
okay. Sure, there's a lot of them, but what's one that just comes out of you?
East of Midnight.
East of Midnight.
East of Midnight. That's one of my very best ones.
Put me somewhere east of midnight, west of the turnpike, anywhere I want.
I don't do that. I used to do it with this. No, do you know why I don't do it, though?
It's because a funny cat. East of Midnight's my best song. Man, you got to hear that. I don't do that
but
anymore
I did
either.
I did it for years.
This is my hike. You can come if you like.
My last four or five albums are probably the five best albums I made. But unfortunately, my momentum had run out with the record company at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I still kept producing because
But isn't that interesting? You just said my last four or five albums are the best albums I've ever
made.
Do you really believe that?
Sure.
You do?
Yeah.
You recorded those albums between what period of time?
1982 and 2006.
So you recorded an album in 2006, right before you got sick?
1985. 1985 to
2006.
During 19 years, I made five of the best albums. I finished an album while I was down with the aneurysm. I finished an album there. It took my mind off my condition entirely. So it was very fortuitous that I had a whole bunch of stuff sitting in the can at the time, as they used to say. And the best one of the whole lot is East of Midnight.
Do you write songs now?
I always have four or five tunes on the back burner.
Your wife is practically groaning behind you, nodding her head like, yes, of course.
There's always tunes on the back burner.
Beautiful songs.
When you write songs now, what do you write about?
I just write about...
If you say jumping from one balcony to the other,
whimsy.
I'm going to kill you.
I just write about whimsy. I try to sound intelligent.
Right.
You know?
What's on your mind now?
Well, I was thinking about the one that has the turtle in it. I like that. I think she likes the fact that I introduce a turtle into this song.
It's more than that.
Is that the part that you like about it, darling?
You know what I'm seeing here? It's amazing. It's amazing. Your wife is this gorgeous young woman, and I realize the glue of this marriage is you write songs about turtles for your wife. That's amazing.
No, that's
I don't
just
have
one,
that advantage.
That's just one scene.
I've got to bullshit my wife every day and convince her into staying with me. And you just sit there and go, I wrote this song for you, baby.
And it contains
I wrote a
turtle.
Song about a turtle.
I know. It's like... come, if you will, while the earth is still fertile. Lady, I see society through the eyes of a turtle. Turtles are soft, and they've got feelings, too. Maybe they think too quickly for me or for you, and it really doesn't matter.
We got to end there. Maybe not.
Just to show you the kind of stuff it is. Okay.
Into the microphone,
come
please.
Come, if you will, back to the stable. Lady, I see Marilyn Monroe, and there stands Clark Gable. He'll milk the cow, she'll stop the show. There's many a good hand felt a chilly wind blow, and it doesn't really matter. Don't ask her, you know, why I write that stuff.
Yeah, ask him about For Loving Me. That's a...
Oh, yeah, well, see, I sang it for 25 years, but it's really a vicious, it's just a very vicious song, an unrequited love song. And it was written during the time when I was still married, and I wondered, my goodness, what does my... it was like almost like Wilt Chamberlain. I've had 100 more like you, I'll have 1,000 for him through, was one of the lines in it. And I was married to someone. And I hated singing the song, and finally I stopped singing it, the same way as I stopped drinking in 1982. But even that only lasted for 23 years.
Then you sang it again.
No.
You don't sing the song. You won't sing it.
No, I don't. A lot of people do, but
other people record it, and you won't sing it.
Even Elvis Presley said,
For Loving Me.
That's what you get for loving me.
I got to say, I look at these album covers, you're one of the best-looking guys I've ever seen in my life. I mean, was that tough for you? Was that a tough part of your career?
You
think it helped you?
Probably. I'm sure it did, but I'm sure it must have.
What's next? When are you going on the road again?
Friday morning.
I feel a little blue, 'cause I can't sew. Still a lot of things that I should know. Anyone can guess. I don't know how to press my Saturday clothes.
Everyone, this is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
I feel a little sad to watch them leave. I don't